unto the breach, dear friend. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and I'll even say it, boys and girls. That might be aspirational, but I'll say it anyway. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure, and on the phone with me, I have Elder Baldy Jeff McClure. Are you there, sir?
I think I am, but I'm not completely sure.
All right. It's good to hear your voice. That's working. Do you want to do the disclosures for our program, the Personal Wealth Coach?
Well, we start off by saying that the Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of a radio program, which you've probably already figured out, but it's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm, which is neither approved nor disapproved by the SEC. That's just who regulates them. That's who we're registered with. The SEC-registered investment advisory firm is based in Salado, Texas, and the principals of that firm happen to be the two guys that are on this show. Listen, tell. Radio program.
Yes. When he said listen, tell, it's because why is a radio program called a radio show? Showing implies the act of observation.
Well, I'm observing you.
Well, that's changing the thing observed. Heisenberg's involved here. See, you're looking at me enough that I'm changing before your eyes.
Me too. And let's see, not only are we an SEC-registered investment advisory firm and give investment advice, when we're on the radio program, we don't give investment advice. We give educational information, which is different because educational information is designed to apply to everyone, whereas information, Registered investment advisors give investment advice, which is to individuals that they advise, and they advise on a fiduciary basis, and educational information is different. Not that it's not fiduciary, it's just that it's for a lot of people. See, I think I got that right. We do not pay for this radio program, nor are we paid to do the radio program. We do advertise on KTEM, but we advertise for the radio program, which if you want to go figure that one out, you probably get a Nobel Prize in physics or anthropology or something.
You're right.
And let's see, what else? The information we provide on this radio program, this educational information, is obtained from sources we deem, this is my one time a week I get to use the word deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to its accuracy or completeness.
Awesome.
Did I get everything?
I think so. You said both warranty and guarantee were not being made, so that's good.
I deemed.
You deemed. Yeah, I think we got everything.
But I didn't redeem.
No. No, you didn't.
We're still figuring out how to do this because Jeff, the guy who's talking right now, is actually sitting in his man cave at home being isolated without any ice.
No isolation ice. It's sad.
And Jake is physically in the radio studio. By the way, if you want to talk to us, you can't. But you can communicate with us. You can send us an email at either jeff@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. Or if you want to, you can say send it to jeff@thepersonalwealthcoachdesk.com, all one word if you'd like to type. Or you can send an email to jake@tpwc.com. And I think that's pretty much it.
Yeah. I wanted to reassure the folks out there listening that we're also working on this technical issue. The studio's not. Studio is under duress at the moment. The COVID is not being kind to radio advertising. But we will be setting up our own facility to be able to take calls and so on at some point in the future. It won't be the normal studio calls. It'll be a different line. But when you call in, we'll be able to talk to you. We're also doing a podcast that hasn't actually done yet, but we're creating the podcast, and we'd like to hear your input as to what you'd like us to talk about on the podcast, what kind of format you'd like it to be. We're doing 2 hours of program here, but would you like it to be free-ranging, or would you like it to be topic-based, that sort of thing?
I think it ought to be in cages.
And if you have, yes, free-range conversations as opposed to cage-free.
Free-range, yeah.
Yeah. I generally have purchased free-range eggs, but I don't know what the point is. They don't wander.
They do if you put them on a slant.
I guess they could roll downhill, and that would be the free-range. They get pre-scrambled. I'm noticing a lot of free-range eggs in my refrigerator, and that's probably how they got there. Why did the chicken cross the road chasing its free-range egg? You know, someday I want to live in a land where chickens' motives are not always questions. I mean, why should we question their motive? Just let them cross the road. I'm sorry. We can talk about the market now.
Well, the stock market continued doing irrational things this week. It moved up 2.45% for the week, the S&P 500, which is pretty amazing. A 2.45% rise in the S&P 500 is something historically we've seen when there's a huge increase in GDP or an unexpected low unemployment rate or somebody turned in huge earnings that nobody expected, and he went up 2.45%. And reading the stuff in the Wall Street Journal, this is from the traders saying, why did you feel very optimistic and buy? Why do you think people are buying a bunch of stock? And the answer was on hope that a generous stimulus bill will emerge from Congress and be signed by the president. I think we're in one of those situations right now where the market is going up because the market is going up.
Yeah. Yeah, there's been a tremendous earnings season for some companies and a horrible earnings season for other companies. And the companies that have had good earnings have been boosted way beyond that value of earnings, way beyond. So people want to be optimistic, and I don't blame them, but we have to be careful about taking risk scenarios. And this is what you said, the market did something irrational again this week. Can we explain why we think it's irrational that the market went up this week?
Well, it's irrational. It's exuberant.
Yeah.
It's irrationally exuberant.
I kind of like it, the fact that there's some exuberance going on. Schiller actually said that first. He's got a book called it way before Alan Greenspan said it.
Yeah, but he didn't get the press coverage. Who reads Schiller's books?
Yeah, only economists.
Only economists read it, so... And, you know, they have diseases that cause them to bore people to death, so nobody pays any attention. But when the Alan Greenspan would say something, everybody would listen. It really boils down to the fact that people behave in herds. And if a stock is going up, that is an irrational statement by itself. Stocks neither go up nor down. They have gone up or have gone down. But they don't have real momentum except for the fact that sentiment causes people to want to get in. We have something going on now that we had going on in the late 1990s and up into 2000, and that is a lot of people with a lot of time on their hands doing individual trades. It's a lot of amateurs trading in the market right now, and they're buying. We have the largest quantity of fractional share trading in history going on. I don't know if you knew that or not.
The largest what in history?
Fractional trades. In other words, Amazon's price is so high that people can't afford to buy a share.
Yeah, Fidelity.com, a trading platform, Robinhood.com, trading platform. Robinhood, the app, it's not even a .com. They have really, really made it available for a lot of people. I don't think people understand how they work. We can go into that if you'd like, too.
Yeah, we already have a question, but let's talk about the markets a little more.
Okay.
The important thing to understand about what's going on in the stock market right now is it's being driven by about 5 or 10 stocks. 26% of the Standard & Poor's 500 stock index right now is 10 stocks. And... you know the ones that are famous at the top. And they are knocking the ball out of the park, tremendously high growth rate in the stock price, not necessarily in the earnings. And they are shooting up into the stratosphere. Meanwhile, the other side of the market, the value side of the market, for instance, is instead of being up 3.73% year-to-date, the value side is down about 12% year-to-date, whereas the growth side is up about 18-20% year-to-date. And if you look at the United States economy and where we'll be in a year, which is what the stock market is really all about, where will the economy, where will earnings be in a year? I don't see that the United States economy will be 20% better a year from now than it was at the end of 2019. Matter of fact, all the evidence suggests it's going to be down about 12%, which is about where the value side of the market is. So I hope we're wrong, but it looks to me like we're set up to what Alan Greenspan called irrational exuberance.
Yeah, and I agree with that. There's parts of the market that, and let me say this also, I kind of like that there's exuberance somewhere in the middle of this plague year. But I believe that people aren't, let me take a step back and say that again in a different way. When we said irrational, when you're saying irrational exuberance, I know there are people out there that are gasping in shock and saying, what do you mean? There's something good happening. Why should you be saying that it won't be good forever? The reality is that most of those big companies have had stellar earnings, the ones that have taken off and left others behind. They've had stellar earnings in comparison to their normal earnings time. But those are all based on one or maybe two time sale issues, not a continuation of sales. Amazon's up because people are ordering more at home because they're stuck at home. Microsoft is up because companies are preparing for external workforce, people working remotely. You see Apple up for same reasons. All of these companies are up because they fit the niche of the demand of this moment. When the vaccine hits, we should say it like a CD drop in our album dropping. When the vaccine drops, what's it going to do to their sales? This is something from a corporate position. If you've just purchased a whole bunch of computer equipment, it's going to be a while before you do it again. The reason why Microsoft and Apple and Adobe and all of the major tech companies have been moving to a subscription-type platform on a lot of their areas is to avoid the boom-bust cycle that we're seeing a boom of right now. There's a bust that follows it. It's just the way it is. If you buy a really, really high quality, high expense car, you're probably not going to buy the same car next year. You're probably going to keep that car for a while. And that's the point, is that one-time sale, when's the next time that one-time sale occurs? So if we're basing our valuation for these companies as if these one-time sales occur all the time, that's dangerous. It's great that they are being valued well. Don't get me wrong there. There are people that I know that are clients of ours that have profited greatly from this, and our advice to them right now is take those profits. If you're concentrated in a single stock-type position, you probably should get diversified anyway, and it's a good time to do it if your stock price is way above where it's supposed to be. So from our perspective, there's actionable stuff. The people that are offended when we say the market's not acting rationally are generally the people that don't want it to act rationally. They would rather they're saying, don't remind people, I like this, I'm making money.
Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about here and what Jake's talking about. The United States economy is the largest in the world, and it is the most successful in the world, but it's also taking the biggest hit due to the coronavirus, because we haven't controlled the coronavirus very well among the developed countries. For instance, in Europe, the coronavirus is largely under control and they're returning to normal, which is, by the way, if you take a look at what's going on with the euro, at the depth of the coronavirus pandemic panic, the euro and the dollar approached 1-to-1 valuation. It now takes $1.16 to buy 1 euro. Why has the euro been rising? Well, because the European nations have done a really good job of getting the pandemic under control and are gradually returning to a normal economy, the United States is still on the downside at this point. We've recovered less than halfway back to where we were, and all the indications are we're starting to sag again, not because of government action, not because of shutdown, because there's just a lot of fear of the coronavirus, and it is still spreading literally like wildfire in the United States.
Yeah.
And as a result, we're going to take some long-term economic damage.
May I throw a piece in here?
Let me throw one more thing.
Go ahead.
Roughly 50% of the small businesses, and small businesses mean not gigantic, doesn't mean mom and pop, although they're included. Roughly 50% of small businesses in the United States are suffering economic stress from the coronavirus, and about half of those don't expect to survive into next year when the vaccine becomes widely available.
Right.
In other words, if you lose 25%, and that's what we look like we're going to use, of the small businesses in the United States, and you have a lot of people who can't pay their rent, can't pay their mortgages, and have their credit messed up, and have their perhaps lose their houses and be evicted from where they're paying rent, or get way behind on their rent, this is not good for the long-term economy. A year from now, the United States economy, and this is just basically where the consensus is of economists, is going to be down about 12% a year from now versus where it is today, where it was at the end of 2019. And it's going to take us about 2.5 years total to get through this thing. And that's the reality of where we are. But the stock market The stock market is telling us everything is fine.
From that perspective, I am going to jump in and say something here. The thing that I was going to say, I'm still going to say, but I want to say this too. I wouldn't be, I was going to say I wouldn't be surprised if this gets called, but I'll just go ahead and call it. This is a depression. The technical definition of a depression, there's three of them out there. There's no common definition. But two of the three, all three of them actually, talk about a structural reason, a structural economic reason why employment is no longer possible at the rate that it was. Well, this counts. What happened in the Great Depression is the structural reason was much more long-lasting. The structural reason was people were walking behind a plow being pulled by a mule, and then a tractor came into the field. And all 20 people that were doing that, 19 of them had to go find work somewhere else. During the 20s, a lot of those people just went and started working in factories building tractors. But at some point, you've got enough people building the tractors, and so we had excess unemployment. There was a structural reason. They were not educated to do the next level of work that they needed to do. And it took World War II and the GI Bill to get them educated to a place where they could change what their employment opportunities were. Today, we have a structural reason why employment's not possible. It isn't a business reason. It's a structural reason. That falls under two or all three definitions of depression have that in it. The last definition of depression, the one that doesn't quite fit, is that it needs to last between at least 2 years, where a recession is generally just two quarters. Well, just looking at this, recovery, what you just said, is likely to take 2.5 to 3 years to get our economy back to the same footing that it was. That now meets, from my perspective, all the definitions of a depression. A Great Depression, I don't think it's that. It isn't like the Great Depression. The structural reason is temporary. Go ahead.
Well, it's very similar, and we're paralleling almost exactly. I know this falls into the heading of weirdness. The 1920-21 Depression. It was called the Forgotten Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And we're paralleling it almost exactly. It was triggered largely, although the Federal Reserve certainly exacerbated it, it was triggered largely by the so-called 1918 flu that really didn't hit. The strongest wave of the 1918 flu hit in 1920.
Right.
The third wave. And it really devastated the economy. And the Federal Reserve was still trying to fight inflation. And World War One was involved in the middle of all of this. So it's hard to sift this out. But we're following the pattern almost exactly.
Yeah. So the other thing that I was going to say about this is that when people bring politics into the market, they're almost always wrong. The market is numbers-based long-term. Short-term, you can get a boost from politics, either left or right. It doesn't matter. It happens both ways. When you think because your person is in control, the market will go up, there's a problem with that, and I had to explain this to some liberal clients about Obama, and I have to explain it to conservative clients about Trump, that politics is not what's driving the market. Yeah, you can get a drive in the market based on tax reforms. You can get the drive in the market on a lot of issues, but those are temporary until it restructures itself to the new valuation system. So that's just an important piece. And I study behavior, not politics. And behavior says that business is down not because of lockdowns. If we look at what happened in Sweden, there was no official lockdown and business was down. Business is down because of behavior. People don't want to get sick. It's pretty simple. And there are people that say, I won't get sick, and they're continuing on. But there's a larger number of people that are saying, I might get sick. I don't want to do whatever it is that they would normally have done to spend money. There are also restrictions against doing it in a lot of places. So the behavior of this is what's really keeping businesses down. And this is a good behavior. We don't want people to go out and get sick so that they can keep the economy up, because enough people can die from it to make the economy much more difficult to recover. But we do have several questions out there waiting for us.
Yes, we do, and we still have a little bit of market to talk about.
Okay, let's finish up the market. Then we've got a question about swap lines. And for those of you that don't know what that is, we'll get into swap lines. It's kind of an important thing. And then we also have a question about performance differentials between amateur investors or day traders and people that use fiduciaries, and we'll get into that information as well. So go ahead and finish up with the market.
It's important to note to take a look at the Treasury yield curve and where the 10-year Treasury note is at any given moment. And sometimes people wonder why I focus on that. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note is the benchmark for all other interest rate yields in the United States, longer-term interest rate yields. And it's currently yielding, in other words, if you loan money to the United States Treasury, it's currently yielding 0.542% a year. In other words, you bought a new 10-year Treasury from the Federal Reserve Bank in Dallas, which you can do, you get 0.5% a year, whether you need it or not. That is absurdly low. And it stay, and if you back down to the shorter yields, the shorter durations out to about 3 years, it's effectively zero. In essence, all the many, many people in many, many nations who trade U.S. Treasuries are forecasting that the need for borrowed money will remain at near 0% for the next 3 years, and then it will gradually start up at a reduced rate. It doesn't anticipate inflation. It doesn't anticipate any great deal of inflation. It doesn't anticipate a great deal of need to borrow money, which in essence is forecasting a low rate of growth in the economy into the immediate future. So that's important to watch that. The other thing that's important to watch about the yield curve is its, whether it has got a positive slope to it or a negative slope. It's got a positive slope, which means where the bond market is in essence predicting that we'll have a recovery in about a year to 18 months, but that the recovery will not be as robust as a lot of people are hoping. And then the other thing we look at is the crude oil futures, and they rose a little bit this week to 41.54%, up 2.72% for the week. It's about the same as the stock market was up. In other words, they're forecasting things will be better. But remember, before the pandemic, oil was trading at about $60 a barrel, and the futures are saying that out into the future, even with a vaccine, it's going to be around $40 a barrel, which means they say that the oil market is also predicting out 6 months from now that there will be still be reduced demand for burning oil, which means reduced economic activity. That's the markets.
All right. When you say demand for borrowed money, let me be clear on that. It isn't that the demand for money hasn't risen. So interest rates being low is causing a boom in home purchases and home refinances. It's that there's a lot more supply at the same time that we have a small uptick in demand. The supply is money. Where's it coming from? Well, people are sitting on cash and not spending it. They've got lots of reasons not to spend it. We can see that in the rest of the economy, the spending is not occurring. So you've got money sitting in cash. Well, where is that cash sitting? It's not in mattresses. It's in banks and things. And what do banks do with money? they loan it out. And when they have a lot of money, and all the banks have lots of money, there's lots of money to loan, which means it's easy to get a loan and interest rates stay low. The people that are asking for loans that are capable of receiving them, people that have not been laid off, is a finite group of people. So that demand is likely not to be kept at this level indefinitely. At some point, everybody that's going to refinance their house will have. And then you just have all this money sitting on the sidelines. So that's what he means when we're talking about the bond market, the interest rates being as low as they are. I've seen articles about if you've got a 4% interest rate and a CD and you've got $1 million, that's $50,000 a year. If it's at 1%, you're going to have $5 million to get the same thing. That's pretty simple math to look at that. So that's having an impact. People are looking at that and saying, we can't get the return we want here. And so some people are seeking return in the market with money that they should be careful with. So it's a worrisome proposition. Having said all that, on the other end of this, we do see a boom, a big one, and we've talked about that in the past. So I want to reemphasize that. It sounds like we're down on the market. We are. There's parts of the market that are way overpriced. There's parts of the market that are still really sweet buying opportunities, and they're still significantly down for the year. And when we tell people, hey, I'd rather buy into the parts of the market that are down right now than the parts of the market that are up right now, they go, what do you mean? You're going to buy the losers? You're not going to get in with the winning team? And my response is probably the same as yours on that. I believe in buy low, sell high, not the reverse. So that's what we're warning about. There's parts of the market that are significantly high. Now, would you like to start on the swap line question, or would you like me to?
Either one, I can start on it.
Okay.
Basically, we had a question from John about explaining swap lines and their importance, and he sent us a picture of a piece of an article from the Wall Street Journal quoting Andrew Houser, the Bank of England's top markets official. In June, he said those swap lines may be the most important part of the international financial stability safety net that few have ever heard of. When you have large quantities of money being transferred from one nation to another, and we've seen that during this crisis, massive transfers of money. In other words, people have been selling the British pound during the height of the crisis.
And the euro. You talked about that at the beginning. Yeah.
And they're buying dollars. Well, this can result in a shortage of a nation's currency or the euro or in the central bank, and that would lead to the position of the central bank being unable to loan to its own users, its own banks. And so there's this continuous overnight swap that's going on between the central banks. Whereas if the people are buying a lot of dollars and the dollars are in essence disappearing because they're leaving the Federal Reserve's pool of money and they're going into private accounts. And at the same time, when they're selling euros, then all of a sudden the European Central Bank has too many euros. They have a surplus of euros. What they do is they swap out, basically send euros to the United States. They send dollars to the United States. We send the money back and forth wherever it's short. Central banks swap it at whatever the rate is on that day for that currency. They don't try. It doesn't affect the currency rate, the exchange rate, because they do it at that day. And it's generally for a limited period of time, a few days or maybe a few weeks, and then they swap it back at exactly the same rate. But what it does is it keeps the currency levels, the reserve currency levels of the central banks at a fairly constant level in and out day after day after day. Otherwise, you could wind up in a situation where there's massive currency flows from one nation to another of a central bank being short on currency. Over to you.
Right. Okay. So a swap line, it's kind of like simply stated. So we've got this ability for different countries to give each other their own currency. Why is it used? You touched that a little bit. At the height of the crisis, people were dumping the euro because the European outbreak was much quicker onset than the American outbreak. Italy is an example of that. Spain, they had it ratcheting up, and people were looking around, and America still still, we had some. It was starting to take off in New York, but it wasn't that big a deal yet. So a lot of Europeans were buying dollars. They were just converting their money. And where do they do that? They're not converting, they're not calling up the Federal Reserve. There's not a place in an airport that you can make a direct line to the Federal Reserve and convert your euro to dollars. There's a bunch of different currency exchange mechanisms. And some of those get loans from the central banks to say, hey, you need more euros. You're out of euros. Here's some euros, and you pay us some money for that. And so there's this, it's like a commodity that's being traded. And these swap lines, if they're closed down, what could happen here is in a sudden shift, like what we saw during the really nasty outbreak in Europe, when Italy was singing from their balconies and so on, and Venice was completely empty. During that time period, people were selling euros at a rate that dropped the price of the euro down to the price of the dollar, or very near it. That's a massive drop. And if there weren't enough dollars present at those exchange locations, it wouldn't affect the price of the dollar internationally, but it certainly would affect the price of the euro internationally. If there's not enough dollars on hand in Europe to convert European money into American money, then the value of the European money drops drastically. Like in the past, different currencies have dropped 50% due to short-term shortages of currency. So when you go to convert your money and you think, I've got 50 euros, I'm going to get, 60 bucks, it should be good. And you show up and they say, no, you get 50 bucks. Well, you could just as easily show up and say, you get 25 bucks. And this is only 2 days after you got 50 bucks. And the reason is because there's just not enough dollars on hand at the location. So the Federal Reserve has opened up these lines to the central banks of other countries to say, yeah, we've got lots of dollars floating around over here. You may not have access to them right now. A country that has none of that is China. So China doesn't want its currency to be traded at all outside of China. So it has no swap lines. And it's caused some issues. If you're working in China and you want to come back to the United States, getting your money out of China is rather difficult. Enough so that billionaires have instead done things like bought the largest trove of aluminum on the planet so that they could convert it to dollars outside of the country. So that's what swap lines are. They do provide a great deal of currency stability, particularly for smaller countries. Hopefully we have beaten that horse today. Also for larger countries, but specifically, worst case scenario is the smaller countries with smaller currencies.
An example of how this works, the money market funds are critical to have money in them. And we had a stress late in 2019, there was some stress where money market funds were basically running out of money to trade. And you basically, when you buy into a money market fund, you're putting some money in there to be loaned to somebody else short term. And the money market funds were literally running out of money because of low interest rates. People weren't putting money in their money market funds. So the Federal Reserve started loaning money to money market funds. It sounds a little strange. But what that does is it keeps the liquidity of the system working. We have a system where a lot of contracts trade every day, and physical money isn't shipped to Europe, and Europe isn't shipping physical money to the United States. It's important to keep liquidity up. We ran into a liquidity crisis in 2008, which is part of the reason that the market plunge took place, and we had the Great Recession in 2008 and 2009, is because we ran into a liquidity crunch. Literally, there was a shortage of cash. The Great Depression was widely attributed to a critical shortage of liquidity, of money. We just basically didn't have enough money to do business. And so one of the Federal Reserve's main jobs is to keep the cash flow available, keep liquidity available, and it has to do that across multiple currencies, and that's what the credit line swaps are about.
All right, now
credit swap lines.
Yeah, credit swap lines. It's It is sort of similar to the credit default swaps that insurance companies do with each other, but not at the same time. So there's some similarities. And the word swap is not the only similarity. They're providing liquidity to each other in the event that things go in a bad direction.
And now we got the question from Tom about individual trading versus fiduciary.
Yeah. And there's not a direct answer to that, but I can give you several locations. I'm sure you've got a couple of more. Dalbar has done a long-term study on people in the market and mutual funds in the same market and indexes in the same market. And there are other studies by the CFP board and by several other major institutions similar to them that says that the act of not selling may be the thing that is most important from an advisor's perspective, not selling in a panic. And there is some small amount of earning there. The big thing, Dalbar's study says that the S&P 500 since 1980-something. I'll have to look at that again. It might be 91. Dalbar started doing... No, it's 82. They started doing a long-term survey-based study on the average performance of your just average person in the market. So how do you get that? Well, people have to agree to share that information. This is one of the issues that is difficult to do long-term studies on, is that when people aren't doing well in the market, they really don't want to tell people about it. If they're in a study, they tend to stop answering the questions. Dalbar has had a pretty good result from its long-term study on this, its long-term survey on what people's performance are. And basically, amateurs or day traders in the market that are invested in the same stocks as the index, and the index that it has used for these long-term studies, the S&P 500, they're invested in mutual funds. So this is the study. It's not on people selling stocks and bonds day to day. It's investing in mutual funds. So you can see there's some limitations to this study. The mutual funds, on average, have done better than the S&P 500 during that time period. But the people in those mutual funds have done significantly worse than both the mutual funds, which did better than the index, and the index. And by significantly worse, I mean down in the single 1 or 2% type returns. And Dalbar's results have said repeatedly the reason is inappropriate market timing. They sell when there's a panic and they buy when there is a boom. And the miracle there is that they've got a positive return at all. Over that long period of time, because people behaviorally like to buy when things are going up, and they like to sell when things are going down. It's behavior that goes back to when there's a herd of buffalo charging at you. It's probably better to get out of the way. When we're used to dealing with physics, seeing the market go up causes us to think that it has some kind of weight behind it, like physical momentum. And it has buyer momentum, but that's based on opinion. There's no physical law that says there's a slowdown period before it stops rising. Sometimes it just turns around and goes the other direction. Yeah, go ahead.
Comments on that. For years when I was a stockbroker, I followed several people who used me as a broker. This was before the era of massive discount brokerages. And I watched them trading. And without exception, they did less well than an average mutual fund. I never saw one do any better. And I have taken over portfolios, and we've taken over portfolios from people. For instance, when the man of the family dies and the woman says, my husband traded stocks and he insisted he made huge gains and we were making lots of money on the stocks, but I don't understand it. Would you look at this? We've been able to reconstruct what happened over the years. And in my personal experience in doing that, and I've been doing it for a long time, 37, 38 years now, what I've seen is the guy who was doing all this trading really wasn't making any money at all. I mean, it was amazing. He tremendous amounts of money exchanged hands and went
and several trades. Stocks. Several trades did great.
But you look at the total overall picture of what they were doing, they did poorly, or they did, in many cases, they lost money over the years. I had a guy who came to me once, and he insisted that he'd been making a 35% return per year in his stock market account for the last 10 years. Well, you don't have to, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure out that 35% a year over 10 years, the guy must be a multi-millionaire. Well, he had a few hundred thousand. But he wasn't there. I mean, I looked at it and went back and looked, and he'd actually been losing money over that time period. He really thought he'd been making money hand over fist. In fact, he hadn't been making money. And that's a weird situation. Now, there are exceptions to that. Professional investors, there are people who have a lot of money, who have millions of dollars, sometimes billions of dollars, who do their own investing. Warren Buffett is one that's pretty famous. He's pretty slow motion. He doesn't do a lot of big trades. Well, he doesn't. He does a lot of big trades, but he doesn't trade fast. And he's done very, very well over the years. But the vast majority of the money he's made has been in the last, believe it or not, during the last 5% of the years he's been investing. The point is that professionals, if you're at it full time and you're educated in it and you know what you're doing and you have an ample amount of money to work with, you can probably do pretty well in the market. If you're an amateur and you're trying to compete with professionals in any area, I don't care what it is, whether it's cutting hair or trading in the market or doing law, you're probably not going to do as well as a professional.
Right, and there's a solution to that. You can become a professional. That's what Warren Buffett did. You can decide this is what you're going to do, and you dedicate yourself in the same amount of time that you dedicated to learn whatever your profession is before that, to this profession, and you can do a lot better. I'll go a different direction on this. I've got a lot of talents versus do-it-yourself type projects. I can do carpentry. I can work with concrete. I can do electrical work. I know how to do plumbing. When it comes right down to it, if my toilet breaks, I'm probably going to call a plumber. Could I do it for less money? Maybe. The question, maybe, I mean, I think that given the opportunity, I could probably do it really, really quickly. I could get a toilet fixed and swapped out and in place. But the reality is that it's going to take me longer than I think it is, because I've got to go and get the parts. And anybody that's ever been in the nut and bolt aisle of Home Depot or Lowe's knows what a time warp is. You go in there, and all you need is one thing, one thing. 5 hours later, you come back out with a handful of things and no idea which one is the one you need. Where a professional plumber has them on stock. They do this day by day. The time that it takes me to actually change the toilet might be a little bit longer than them, but it's all the other stuff that adds up. And in the act of day trading in the market, it is a very simple thing of it's all the other things that add up. You need to be watching it all the time if you're a day trader. And that's we generally don't do that. And we've got to play some commercials. Wait a minute. We've got a video conference going. We don't have telephones, but hey, we can look at each other on video. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to join the conversation, the way to do it is through email right now. We'll get that fixed at some point, I have faith. But in the meantime, the email addresses to send to are jeff@tpwc.com and or jake@tpwc.com, and we'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This is Jake McClure and Jeff McClure. You should be on the line. Are you still there?
I think so.
All right. There's a lot of thinking going on around here.
Good idea. We have a question from John. Rich versus wealthy. What's the difference?
Do you mind if I jump in there? I'm going to use your words.
I'm letting you jump because we looked at that. By the way, John, we read that article. I read that article in detail, and there's a book mentioned in there, and I ordered the book. I pre-ordered the book for Jake and I.
Yeah. We've had a long-term definition developed by Elder Baldy here for the difference between rich and wealthy. And it's an internal definition that we use, but we have said this for years, that we don't want to take any rich clients. We would rather have wealthy clients. What's the difference? Well, most people, when you ask them if they're rich, and this includes extremely ultra high net worth, if it's the person that earned the money, they say no. Now, there's people that earn this money through different means. If it's easy to earn the money for them, so if they made a lot of money through sports, through acting, through the lottery, and I'm not saying that sports is easy or that acting is easy. I'm saying that to go from making $100 an hour on a gig and thinking that's great to making $1 million for a gig, what's the difference in workload there? There's very little. If you're in a college team and you're working as hard as you can, there is a difference in effort when you get to the NFL. But it's not massively different. So when you ask people that have that kind of really fast money, if they're rich, they say yes. If you talk to someone that started a business and earned it over 40 years, they say, no, I believe I'm wealthy. Your definition that I've been using for years, and I'm really proud that you came up with this, is most people, when you ask them if they're rich, they say no. But if you ask them if they know anyone that's rich, they may say yes. But then you go and ask the person that they think is rich if they think they're rich, and they'll say no. So what does that mean? The definition that you came up with is rich means more money than you know what to do with. And people that have more money than they know what to do with generally eventually have as much money as they know what to do with, or less. And there's averages on lottery winners to bankruptcy, professional sports stars to bankruptcy. The average person coming with a lottery win is bankrupt in 3.5 years. The average retired sports star goes bankrupt. Because they have more money than they know what to do with. And if you have more money than you know what to do with, then eventually you have as much as you know what to do with. Now, when you ask somebody if they know someone else that's rich, even people that have earned it themselves, a lot of times they say yes, because they're using that same definition. They have more money than I know what to do with. That's rich. And that is the deal here.
Generally speaking, rich is associated with a couple of other words. Filthy rich is a common term that I heard when I was growing up, and I still hear occasionally.
Yeah, this cake is
filthy rich.
This cake is too rich. I hear that a lot as well.
Rich means you got more than if you have a cake that's too rich, that means you can't eat very much of it or you'll get sick.
It's an overabundance.
So rich and wealthy are complete. Wheel is the root word of wealthy. Wheel is where we get real, is in real estate.
And well as in wall.
And we get wealthy people have enough money that they can sustain their standard, a reasonable standard of living for an indefinite period of time, and that's what they're doing. Rich people have money that is going to make them sick if they don't change what they're doing with it. That's simple.
And I think that rich versus wealthy is a really American concept. Rich in Britain means something different. Rich is a sarcastic statement about jokes, or about a statement of, you went over the top. I just had a conversation with my daughter about the word fine, that she's not allowed to say fine when her mom tells her that she needs to clean her room. And she answered me slightly angrily, why? Fine means that I'm going to do it. And I said, yes, but when fine is used like that, it means it's opposite. Rich is in that same area. There is that filthy rich component to it. And people feel guilty if they think they're rich. It's part of the reason why they go bankrupt.
They have something called a poverty trigger. And when you say rich, you're pulling the poverty trigger. That means that you will reduce yourself back to poverty at some point.
If you believe you worked hard for the assets that you've acquired, if you believe that you can look at that dollar, whatever one of them, out of however many you have, and say, each of those was earned by me, you don't feel guilty about it. If you believe you earned the money, it's not something that will pull the poverty trigger. If you look at it and you look at your friends and the people you grew up with and they don't have it and you didn't do anything that different than them, you tend to think of yourself as rich, and over a long period of time, that guilt can pull you back down. Go ahead. We're almost out of time.
There's a term that you, there's something you've repeated again and again and again, and that is the upper 1% is in continuous turnover. Very few people remain in the upper 1% of income.
You sound like you're reading that somewhere, like somebody's been listening to me or something.
Yeah, I have. I have to listen to you for 2 hours every Saturday morning, whether I like it or not.
Or at least half of it. We're about out of time for this hour. We will be back next hour with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, and we'll talk about some more of the behavioral concepts that cause people to be successful or unsuccessful. I think that's important.
And the unemployment.
Yeah, Alan, there's a lot of unemployment news. If you'd like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that voicemail on the weekend, real live people during the week, toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. We actually do give fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth. If you'd like to contact us by email, it's jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. On there, you can listen to recordings of the radio program going back years. You can read our newsletter. You can contact us through the contact form there as well. Until next hour, this has been